Once, while Lord Ramachandra was walking at night incognito, Krishna used to do this by the way. Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead in Dwarka, he would go out, the all-knowing, all-powerful Supreme Personality of Godhead would go out at night incognito to find out what the citizens were thinking. Hiding himself by disguise to find out the people's opinions of him, of himself, he heard a man speaking unfavorably about his wife Sita Devi. Speaking to his own unchaste wife, the man said, "You go to another man's house and therefore you are unchaste and polluted. I shall not maintain you anymore. A hen-pecked husband like Lord Rama may accept a wife like Sita who went to another man's house. But I am not hen-pecked like him, and therefore I shall not accept you again." Sukadev Goswami said, "Men with a poor fund of knowledge and a heinous character speak nonsensically. And fearing such rascals, Lord Ramachandra abandoned his wife Sita Devi, although she was pregnant. Thus Sita Devi went to the ashram of Valmiki Muni. When the time came, the pregnant mother Sita Devi gave birth to twin sons, later celebrated as Lav and Kush. The ritualistic ceremonies for their birth were performed by Valmiki Muni. O Maharaj Prakrit, Lord Lakshman had two sons named Angada and Chitraketu, and Lord Bharat also had two sons named Taksha and Pushkal. Shatugna had two sons named Subahu and Shutasen. When Lord Bharat went to conquer all directions, he had to kill many millions of Gandharvas who were generally pretenders. Taking all their wealth, he offered it to Lord Ramachandra. Shatugna also killed a Rakshasa named Lavan, who was the son of Madhu Rakshasa. Thus he established in the great forest known as Madhuvan, the town known as Mathura. Being forsaken by her husband, Sita Devi entrusted her two sons to the care of Valmiki Muni. Then meditating upon the lotus feet of Lord Ramachandra, she entered the earth. She could not live in separation from Lord Ram. After hearing the news of Mother Sita's entering the earth, the Supreme Personality of Godhead was certainly aggrieved. Although he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, upon remembering the exalted qualities of Mother Sita, he could not check his grief in transcendental love. Now please listen carefully. Lord Ramachandra's grief at the news of Sita Devi's entering the earth is not to be considered material. Now remember, what canto are we in? Yes. Lord Ramachandra, what does maryada mean directly?
Discipline?
Yeah.
Maryada vitikrama means to surpass a superior.
Yeah, it means like the proper way of behavior. You looking it up? Or disciplines? So Lord Ramachandra is known as the maryada purushottam. Which means?
Maryada means limits or frontier or border, and therefore it means the limits of morality and propriety.
So the rules and regulations. He was very strictly regulated in what he did and how he acted. So when there was the slightest criticism of Mother Sita, that reflected upon him. So therefore, if the citizens are criticizing him, then he cannot rule. Of course he can rule by the strength of his armies, but then everything is by force and you cannot really rule, because if you're ruling by law or by force, what do people do behind your back and through the different means? They can always outwit the law. But when there's a love in the relationship and full respect, then they follow the laws completely. So this Marjada Purushottam, this was Lord Ramachandra and how he acted. So one could say he followed the prescriptions and the limitations of that of an ideal person. But yet, he was the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There is a difference between him as the Mayadav Purushottam and Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There's a difference in the activities. Lord Ram showed the ideal way to behave, and Krishna displayed his full personality, the full Supreme Personality of Godhead. So right before we're going into the 10th canto, where we hear about Krishna, we're hearing about Lord Ramachandra, who is in a human form, different from Varahadev and Lord Nrisingadev and Ajita and Matsya. And in the last canto, who was it? Vamanadev, the dwarf Brahman. But here is a person who's acting ideally. So the concept of God is a person who's acting as the Mujjara Purushottam, as the perfect example for everyone else to follow, is there, and that's easier to accept. But that concept is being put in place. And then in the next canto, we'll meet Krishna, who breaks all the rules of what is appropriate behavior according to human standards, to display the fact with his most intimate devotees that he is the supreme exhibition of the personality of Godhead. But here, in this particular verse and this particular purport, Prabhupada is the verse explains that Ramachandra is experiencing what?
Grief.
Why? Because he loves Sita Devi. Remembering Sita Devi, he could not check his grief in transcendental love. So this type of a mood prepares us to enter in Vrindavan. Ramachandra is experiencing it in the midst of his acting as a perfect transcendental person. And Krishna experiences it to the highest degree, as do the rest of the residents of Vrindavan, as he exhibits his activities as the Supreme Personality of Godhead in Brajadam. But it is not material. In the spiritual world also there are feelings of separation. Now we're really indirectly, because Vrindavan is not mentioned, or Krishna's Leela in Vrindavan isn't mentioned, but actually this is describing Vrindavan. And the difference between the material grief and the spiritual grief of Vrindavan is these. Award those who experience them the highest transcendental ecstasy, because they are not material at all. All we have in our treasury of experiences under the category of grief is unhappiness. But this type of spiritual unhappiness is actually transcendental ecstasy. And of course, how can we understand this with the finite mind? But through the Bhagavatam and the commentaries, we can. And by this time in the Bhagavatam, we should. Grief in the spiritual world, grief and separation exists even in the absolute. But such feelings of separation in the spiritual world are transcendentally blissful. The absolute is that which, the absolute truth is that which everything emanates. So that which we experience in this world is a reflection of that which is experienced in ecstasy in the spiritual world. Such feelings are a sign of tasya prema vasyatva swabhava, being under the influence of the ladini shakti and being controlled by love. And this is Vrindavan. Ladini Shakti, Radha Krishna Pranaya Vakrita Ladini Shakti Azmar. All the dealings between Radha and Krishna, they are under the Ladini Shakti. This is how Krishna experiences pleasure. Nothing outside of himself, but in relationship to his Ladini Shakti. In the material world, such feelings of separation are only a perverted reflection. They are a reflection. So the fact they're a reflection means two things. On one level, we can't understand the spiritual, but on another level, we can understand the spiritual. We can't impose the qualities of the reflection upon the actual object, but we can get an idea of what the object is like by understanding the nature of the reflection. The attraction between men, just talking about Vrindavan, preparing us for the 10th canto. The attraction between man and woman, or male and female, although exists everywhere, always exists everywhere, making everyone always fearful. Such feelings are present amongst even the controllers like Brahma and Lord Shiva, and is the cause of fear for them, what to speak of others who are attached to household life in this material world. Purport. As explained above, when the feelings of love and transcendental bliss from the spiritual world are pervertedly reflected in this material world, they are certainly the cause of bondage and misery and fear, because separation must be there. So whether one has love or doesn't have love, it will cause anxiety and fear. And in the spiritual world, that's ecstasy. And in the material world, it's suffering. As long as men feel attracted to women in this material world, and women feel attracted to men, the bondage of repeated birth and death will continue. So, because what is the essence of that attraction? It is false ego. And that is the difference between being in the spiritual world and the material world. In the spiritual world, there is no false ego. There is the real, ego means identity, the real, the person is living in his actual identity in relationship with Krishna. In the material world, we live in a false identity, imagining that we are the controllers and we can enjoy. And the prime object for enjoyment is the members of the opposite sex. In the spiritual world, there is no fear of birth and death. Such feelings of separation are the cause of transcendental bliss. In the absolute reality, there are varieties of feelings, but all of them are of the same quality of transcendental bliss, but there's variety. And this is the unique contribution of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, of course, in great detail, but unity in variety, achintya, bhed, that yes, everything is of the same quality in the spiritual world of ecstasy, but there are unlimited varieties. It won't get boring there, because what do you think? Well, you know, when you think in the material world, the person in the material world, because every religion talks about going to heaven. But what do people think heaven is like? It's hard to say. If you've read the Quran, they have a really interesting concept. You know, it's like a great garden and things like that, and it's really fun there, and you have all the fun you want. And that's what people basically conceive of what heaven is like. It's like the material world, but the problems of the material world don't exist, and you really enjoy there. So therefore, the sense of false ego never leaves one, and the reaction against that in religiosity and spiritual seeking is when people say, well, couldn't it be like that, then they think of just a oneness, of losing a loss of individuality as what the spiritual world must be, because it can't be just a garden. We have as much fruit as you want, and there's wonderful angels playing, etc., etc. Where's God in the whole equation? What's your relationship with Him? And if He's the Creator, that means He existed before the creation. Well, what was He doing? So it doesn't... So this really answers... Krishna consciousness will answer this. And heaven isn't about me. Heaven's about Him and her. The spiritual world is about how to enhance His enjoyment. It's not about how to enhance my enjoyment. So when we talk about it, it's so obvious in one sense. But it's obvious because we're on the ninth canto of the Bhagavatam. So Lord Ramachandra, after Mother Sita entered the earth, Lord Ramachandra observed complete celibacy because he had taken Ekapatni Vrata, one wife, and performed an uninterrupted Agnihotra Jagya for 13,000 years. After completing the sacrifice, Lord Ramachandra, whose lotus feet were sometimes pierced by thorns when he lived in Dandakaranya, he placed those lotus feet in the hearts of those who always think of him. This is very wonderful, isn't it? And especially if we think of it in relationship to Sisi Radha Shyama Sunda. Then he entered his own abode, the Vaikuntha planet, beyond the Brahma Jyoti. He placed his lotus feet in the hearts of those who always think about him. So that points to the primary processes of advanced devotional service. The smaranam that comes from kirtanam, the remembrances. Always think of him with great love. Not only think of him, not like Kamsa, but anyavilasita sanyam. Yanakama anavrita, anukulena, it has to be anukul, or in a favorable mood, always thinking about him, who always think of him in devotion. Then he left his own abode, he entered his own abode, the Vaikuntha planet, beyond the Brahma Jyoti. Purport. The lotus feet, we'll read the first paragraph. The lotus feet of the Lord are always a subject matter for meditation, for devotees. And Mahaprabhu has taught that, and Sanatana Goswami especially, that the best way to enhance our remembrance is kirtan. Sometimes, and therefore kirtan is more prominent than even smaranam, but smaranam is very much what we're interested in. The lotus feet of the Lord are always a subject matter for meditation for devotees. Sometimes, when Lord Ramachandra wandered in the forest of Dandakaranya, thorns pricked his lotus feet. The devotees, upon thinking of this, would faint. Does this remind you of something? Yeah.
The gopis Krishna.
What verse? Does anyone know it? It's the last verse of Gopi Gita, which someone said the first line. I maybe continue some of it. This was all the concern of the residents of Vrindavan. You know, they just were worried about Krishna's welfare. This is what it means to be a devotee. The devotees, upon thinking of this, would faint, and that would be another kind of ecstasy because there is no false ego. The Lord does not feel pain or pleasure from any action or reaction of this material world. But the devotees cannot tolerate even the pricking of the Lord's lotus feet by a thorn. This was the attitude of the gopis when they thought of Krishna wandering in the forest with pebbles and grains of sand pricking his lotus feet, ankur, and little seedlings, sprouts. The devotees, who could not tolerate even thinking of the Lord's lotus feet being pricked by a thorn, were again put into tribulation by thinking of the Lord's disappearance. For the Lord had to return to his abode after finishing his pastimes in the material world. So we're being prepared to enter Vrindavan. Lord Ramachandra's reputation for having killed Ravana with a shower of arrows at the request of the demigods, and for having built a bridge over the ocean, does not constitute the factual glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Ramachandra, whose spiritual body is always engaged in various pastimes. So what did that verse say? I read most of it. What did that verse say? But what does it say?
It says that
he killed Ravana. Ramachandra is so great He killed Ravana on behalf of the demigods. Oh, Ramachandra is so great and so glorious because he built a bridge to Lanka. But the verse said this is not actually his glory, the full manifestation or understanding of his glory. And the hint is, whose spiritual body is always engaged in various pastimes. Lord Ramachandra has no equal or superior, and therefore he had no need to take help from the monkeys to gain victory over Ravana. In other words, he can do exactly as he wanted. He can do just as he wants. He doesn't need the monkeys. He doesn't need a bridge. He doesn't need his arrows to recover Sita. He's engaging in pastimes. So it's not the pastime itself, the specific pastime on one level, that's the one most wonderful thing. Let's hear what, because it doesn't say so much, there's a hint, but that it's pastimes, his activities with his devotees. But it doesn't express the positive clearly. But let's read Prabhupada's purport. As stated in the Vedas, Svatasvatara Upanishad 6.8, Natasyakajam karanam navidyate natatsamaschava vikarasta drisyate parasya shakti vividaya suvite swabhavika janabala kriyacha. The Supreme Lord has nothing to do, and no one is found to be equal or greater than him, for everything is done naturally, swabhavika, and systematically by his multifarious energies, jnana, bala, kriya. The Lord has nothing to do. Natasya karajam karanam navidyate. Whatever he does is his path. Although he has nothing to do, still he does. He acts. This is amazing. Because again, we tend to think, using our finite minds, that because we act to do something, because that implies that we're lacking something. So therefore, God, who by definition doesn't lack anything, just like if I milk the cow, because either I lack milk, or I lack money, or I lack ghee, or I lack something. Otherwise, there's no impetus to work, to do. If I had all the milk in the world in a big, huge pot, if I had billions and billions of gallons, would I be there milking a cow? No, because I don't lack milk. If I had all the unlimited power of the world, would I be doing business to get money, which means power? No, I already have the power. You do things because you lack in this world. So therefore, by definition, God cannot lack anything. Therefore, one would think that therefore he doesn't do, he doesn't act. But this is the materialistic, ascending method, thinking God is going to be like us, using ourselves as the examples, the measure of what he should be doing. But here, it's understood that he's doing everything, he's just playing with his energies. Whenever he has nothing to do, whatever he does is his pastime. So this whole concept or understanding of different pastimes or activities done for just simply to increase his pleasure and the pleasure of his devotees is being introduced here. The Lord has no duty to perform to oblige anyone. Nonetheless, he appears to act to protect his devotees or kill his enemies. Of course, no one can be the Lord's enemy, since who could be more powerful than the Lord? There is no question of anyone being the Lord's enemy. When the Lord wants to take pleasure in pastimes, he comes down to this material world and acts like a human being, thus showing his wonderful, glorious activities. For what purpose? To please his devotees. His devotees always want to see the Lord victorious in various activities, and therefore to please himself in them, the Lord sometimes agrees to act as a human being and perform wonderful, uncommon pastimes for the satisfaction of the devotees and with the devotees. So he kills Ravana, he builds the bridge to Lanka, but he's exchanging humors or rasa with his devotees. He kills Bakasura and Agasura. He lifts Govardhan Hill and all the devotees for 8 days to simply stare at him and perform their pastimes with him under Govardhan Hill. How wonderful. He does it for his pleasure and to give pleasure to the devotees. Lord Ramachandra's spotless name and fame, which vanquishes all sinful reactions, how? By hearing about them and chanting about them, are celebrated in all directions, like the ornamental cloth of the victorious elephant that conquers all directions. Great saintly persons like Mokandeya Rishi still glorify his characteristics in the assembly of great emperors like Maharaj Yudhisthira. Similarly, all the saintly kings and all the demigods, including Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma, worship the Lord by bowing down with their helmets. Let me offer my obeisances unto his lotus feet. Lord Ramachandra returned to his abode, to which bhakti yogis are promoted. This is the place to which all the inhabitants of Ayodhya went after they served the Lord in his manifest pastimes by offering him obeisances, touching his lotus feet, fully observing him as a father-like king, sitting or lying down with him like equals, or even just accompanying him. So what does that remind you of in relationship to Vrindavan? That these peoples, these persons who are with him are not ordinary persons. They are all they come from the spiritual world and they go back to the spiritual world when the pastimes are completed. So read Prabhupada's purport here. The Lord says in Bhagavad Gita, so to understand these facts about the Lord and his pastimes with his associates are very important. Why? Because the Lord says in the Bhagavad Gita 4:9, Janma karma cha me divyam evam yo vetti tat fata takfadam puna janma naiti mameti sa arjana. One who knows the transcendental nature of my appearance and activities does not, upon leaving the body, take his birth again in this material world, but attains my eternal abode, O Arjuna. So just by knowing the actual nature of these activities and pastimes of Krishna, one will not remain in this material world. So how powerful are these pastimes and activities? Here, this is confirmed. All the inhabitants of Ayodhya who saw Lord Ramachandra as citizens, so these are different rasas, these are different, actually, liberations, served him as servants, sat and talked with him as friends, or was somehow or another present during his reign, went back to home, back to Godhead. After giving up the body, the devotee who becomes perfect in devotional service enters that particular universe where Lord Ramachandra or Lord Krishna is engaged in his pastimes. Then after being trained to serve the Lord in various capacities in the Prakat Lila, where it's going on in the material world, the devotee is finally promoted to Sanatan Dham, the supreme abode in the spiritual world. This Sanatan Dham is also mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, Parastasmat tu bhavo anyo vyakto avyaktat sanatana. One who enters the transcendental pastimes of the Lord is called Nitya Lila Pravishta, meaning entering into his eternal pastimes. To understand clearly why Lord Ramachandra returned, it is mentioned herewith that the Lord went to that particular place where the bhakti yogis go. The impersonalists misunderstand the statement of Srimad Bhagavatam to mean that the Lord entered his own effulgence and therefore became impersonal. But the Lord is a person, and his devotees are persons. Indeed, the living entities like the Lord were persons in the past, they are persons in the present. What verse in the Bhagavad Gita? Persons in It's hard to remember back to the second chapter, huh? Kali Yuga. This is also confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. 23. O King Parikit, anyone who orally receives the narrations concerning the characteristics of Lord Ramachandra's pastimes will ultimately be freed from the disease of envy and thus be liberated from the bondage of fruitive activity. So it's envy. If we remove that, because envy springs from our envy of Krishna, of the Supreme Lord, if we remove that, we won't have to take birth. We have no more envy. We're there. Prabhupada's purport. Here in this material world, raise your hand if you've orally received the narrations concerning Lord Ramachandra. Very good. Ultimately be freed from the disease of envy. It must be removed. Here in this material world, everyone is envious of someone else. Even in religious life, it is sometimes found that if one devotee has advanced in spiritual activities, other devotees are envious of him. Such envious devotees are not completely freed from the bondage of birth and death. As long as one is not completely free from the cause of birth and death, means envy, one cannot enter the Sanatana Dham or the eternal pastimes of the Lord. Because if one is envious of someone in this world because they have something we don't have, just imagine how envious we'd be of Krishna, who possesses everything in full. Beauty, wealth, fame, Aishwarya, Puna, knowledge, renunciation, strength, everything. So therefore we can't be allowed into those inner quarters unless envy is removed from our heart. So hearing of the glories of the Lord helps us greatly. One becomes envious because of being influenced by the designations of the body, but the liberated devotee has nothing to do with the body, and therefore he is completely on the transcendental platform. A devotee is never envious of anyone, even his enemy, because the devotee knows that the Lord is his supreme protector. He thinks, what harm can the so-called enemy do? Thus, a devotee is confident about his protection. The Lord says, Yeyitamam prapadyante tamstataiva bhajamyaham. According to the proportion of one's surrender unto me, I respond accordingly. A devotee must therefore be completely free from envy, especially of other devotees. To envy other devotees is a great offense of Vaishnava Parad, means wishing them unfavorableness. A devotee who constantly engages in hearing and chanting Shravana Kirtanam is certainly freed from the disease of envy, and thus he becomes eligible to go back home, back to Godhead. So a very important purport, actually. Prabhupada has spoken about the root of our material existence, implying that it's envy of Krishna, and therefore that will manifest as envy of others. And this also can occur in spiritual life. And when one has envy of others, it means that one is not quite free from this root problem, and therefore one will not become, one is not yet qualified to enter into Golok Vrindavan. And the remedial process of removing envy is to always hear and chant. And if we hear constantly, do this, is certainly freed of this disease. Prabhupada calls it a disease of envy. Do you someone have their online dictionary when you can look up, or just look up envy? Let's see the definition that's given.
A feeling of discontent and ill will.
Ill will, wishing harm to others.
Because of another's advantages, possessions, etc.
Because of another's advantages or possessions, etc.
Result of dislike of another who has something that one desires.
Say again that last sentence.
Resentful dislike.
Sometimes, yes.
Of another who has something that one desires.
Yes.
And obsolete ill will or spite.
Yes. Wishing harm to others, malice. Mm-hmm. 24. Maharaj Prickett inquired from Sukadeva Goswami, how did the Lord conduct himself and how did he behave in relationship with his brothers who were expansions of his own self? How did his brothers and the inhabitants of Ayodhya treat him, treat the Lord? Sukadeva Goswami replied, and in this verse there's an important purport, and that's more or less going, and there's one more short purport, and then that will bring us to the end of the chapter. Sukadeva Goswami replied, because the question is what? How did he treat his brothers? How did they interact? After accepting the throne of the government by the fervent request of his younger brother. What does fervent mean?
Huh? Very intense.
Enthusiastic, yes. And sincere, too, but it's mostly intense enthusiasm. By the fervent request of his younger brother Bharata, Lord Ramachandra ordered his younger brothers to go out and conquer the entire world, while he personally remained in the capital to give audience to all the citizens and residents of his palace and supervise the governmental affairs with his other assistants. Then let's listen to where Prabhupada takes this. The Supreme Personality of Godhead does not allow any of his devotees or assistants to be engaged in sense gratification. The younger brothers of Lord Ramachandra were at home enjoying the personal presence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But the Lord ordered them to go out and achieve victory all over the world. It was the custom, and this custom in some places is still current, that all other kings would have to accept the supremacy of the emperor. If the king of a small state did not accept the emperor's supremacy, there would be a fight, and the king of the small state would be obliged to accept the emperor as the supreme. Otherwise, it would not be possible for the emperor to rule the country. Lord Ramachandra showed his favor to his brothers by ordering them to go out. Many of the Lord's devotees residing in Vrindavan have taken the vow not to leave Vrindavan to preach Krishna consciousness. But the Lord says that Krishna consciousness should be spread all over the world, in every village and every town. This is the open order of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Prithiviti achayata nagarari gram savatra prachara habi moranam. A pure devotee, therefore, must execute the order of the Lord and must not gratify his senses by remaining stagnant in one place, falsely proud, thinking that because he does not leave Vrindavan but chants in a solitary place, he has become a great devotee. A devotee must carry out the order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, Yari Deka Tari Kaha Krishna Upadesh. Every devotee, therefore, should spread Krishna consciousness by preaching, asking whomever he meets to accept the order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Lord says, Savadamam Pratyaja Mamekam Sharanam Braja. Abandon all varieties of religion and just surrender unto me. This is the order of the Lord who speaks as the Supreme Emperor. Everyone should be induced to accept this order, for this is victory, digvijay, victory over all directions. And it is the duty of the soldier, the devotee, to impress upon everyone this philosophy of life. Of course, those who are Kanista Adhikaris do not preach. This is, means Prakriti Bhaktis or materialistic devotees. But the Lord shows mercy to them also, as he did by staying personally in Ayodhya to give audience to the people in general. One should not mistakenly think that the Lord asked his younger brothers to leave Ayodhya because he especially favored the citizens. The Lord is merciful to everyone, and he knows how to show his favor to each individual person according to his, that person's capacity. One who abides by the order of the Lord is a pure devotee. So very important, Prabhupada's again stressing, preaching because it's Krishna's desire. And if we follow Krishna's desire, we gain his mercy. During the reign of Lord Ramachandra, the streets of the capital Ayodhya was sprinkled with perfumed water and drops of perfumed liquor, thrown about by elephants from their trunks. When the citizens saw the Lord personally supervising the affairs of the city in such opulence, they appreciated this opulence very much. So this, I believe, is the last purport in the chapter, and it describes, and the rest of the chapter, I'll read some of it, because this describes the opulence of the Lord of the city. So we'll read some of the other verses describing this. The palaces, the palace gates, the assembly houses, the platforms for meeting places, the temples, and all such places were decorated with golden water pots and bedecked with various types of flags. Wherever Lord Ramachandra visited, auspicious welcome gates were constructed with banana trees and betel nut trees full of flowers and fruit. The gates were decorated with various flags made of colorful cloth and with tapestries, mirrors, and garlands. Wherever Lord Ramachandra visited, the people approached him with paraphernalia of worship and begged the Lord's blessings. O Lord, they said, as you rescued the earth from the bottom of the sea in your incarnation as a boar, may you now maintain it. Thus we beg your blessings. Thereafter, not having seen the Lord for a long time, the citizens, both men and women, being very eager to see him, left their homes and got up on the roofs of the palaces. They loved him. Being incompletely satiated with seeing the face of the lotus-eyed Lord Ramachandra, they showered flowers upon him. Thereafter, Lord Ramachandra entered the palace of his forefathers in Ayodhya. Within this the palaces were various treasures and valuable wardrobes. The sitting places on the two sides of the entrance door were made of coral. What color is coral?
Red.
Reddish. Semi-precious stone. The yards were surrounded by pillars of Vaidurja money. The floor was made of highly polished Marakatta money. That's emerald, yes? Marakatta. And the foundation was made of marble. The entire palace was decorated with flags and garlands and bedecked with valuable stones, shining with a celestial effulgence. So this sounds so amazing. But even the palaces of the Mughals had this. If you see the Red Fort in Delhi, I don't know about the Agra Red Fort, but in Delhi, there you can see how the walls were embedded with so many stones. Semi-precious stones, of course, there. Most of them have been pried out by now. So opulent. So the entire palace was decorated with flags and garlands and bedecked with valuable stones shining with a celestial effulgence. The palace was fully decorated with pearls and surrounded by lamps and incense. So what a wonderful atmosphere. The men and women within the palace all resembled demigods and were decorated with various ornaments, which seemed beautiful because of being placed on their bodies. Lord Ramachandra, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, chief of the best learned scholars, resided in that palace with his pleasure potency, Mother Sita, and enjoyed complete peace. So the question was asked is how he dealt with his brothers and everyone else while he was in Ayodhya. And he lived in his opulence palace. He set them out to be digvijays, conquer all directions, and he supervised the kingdom. Without transgressing the religious principles, Lord Ramachandra, whose lotus feet are worshipped by devotees in meditation, again, this point on meditation, always thinking about him with great love, because it's devotees, so devotees only think of the Lord with love, enjoyed with all the paraphernalia of transcendental pleasure for as long as needed. Let's just go back and read that, the purport 226, about the elephants sprinkling perfumed waters through their trunks. In some cities of the world, I've seen machines, not perfumed water or liquor sprinkled, but just water to clean it, to clean the city streets, the brushes. But not as cool as using an elephant. We have simply heard about the opulence of Ramraja during the reign of Lord Ramachandra. Now here is one example of the opulence of the Lord's kingdom. The streets of Ayodhya were not only cleaned, but also sprinkled with perfumed water and drops of perfumed liquor, which were distributed by elephants through their trunks. There was no need of sprinkling machines, for the elephant has a natural ability to suck water through its trunk and again throw it out in a shower. We can understand the opulence of the city from this one example. It was actually sprinkled with perfumed water. Moreover, the citizens had the opportunity to see the Lord personally supervising the affairs of the state. He was not a sleeping monarch, as we can understand from his activities in sending his brothers to see to affairs outside the capital and punish anyone who did not obey the emperor's orders. This is called Digvijay. The citizens were all given facilities for peaceful life, and they were also qualified with appropriate attributes according to Vanashrama. As we have seen from the previous chapter, Vanashrama Gunanvita, the citizens were trained according to the Vanashrama system, and the king was performing his duties according to Vanashrama, and as he was the Lord in this case, he was setting the proper example. A class of men were Brahmins, a class of men were Kshatriyas, a class were Vaishyas, and a class were Sudras. Without this scientific division, there could be no question of good citizenship. The king, being magnanimous and perfect in his duty, performed many sacrifices and treated the citizens as his sons. And the citizens, being trained in the Vanashrama system, were obedient and perfectly ordered. The entire monarchy was so opulent and peaceful that the government was even able to sprinkle the street with perfumed water. What to speak of other management? Since the city was sprinkled with perfumed water, we can simply imagine how opulent it was in other respects. Why should the citizens not have felt happy during the reign of Lord Ramachandra? So that's a nice way of saying the citizens felt so happy in the reign of Lord Ramachandra, especially since they were able to see him each day as he went about his Vanashrama duties, performing sacrifices and seeing to the management of the state and protecting the citizens. And again, the final verse in this chapter, which will be the final verse we'll read. Without transgressing the religious principles, Lord Ramachandra, being a perfect example, whose lotus feet are worshipped by devotees in meditation, enjoyed with all the paraphernalia of transcendental pleasure for as long as needed. And then what happened? He left, and all the citizens of Ayodhya went with him back to the spiritual world. Okay, thank you very much. Any questions or comments?
Is 14 years of exile seem totally insignificant compared to the rest of his life? Because he spent 13,000 years doing Angiya, Kharyakya.
So yeah, that's interesting.
Is it that KPI actually was type of lenient, I would say, in banishing him for such a short amount of time? Because she felt actually love for him? Or she gave us a manual token banishment?
And what was the cause, if she felt so much love for him, what was the cause of her giving him that even? And yes, it was such a...
It's that thing.
Yeah.
Because 14 years compared to...
Yugayitam namesena chakshushas payeshayitam sunyayitam jagatsavam govinda vidahename. So that wouldn't seem to me... I understand what you're asking, but I've never seen any indication. She was poisoned by bad association, wasn't she? What was her name again? The maid, hunchback?
She was sent by Ravana.
Huh? Mantara. She's the villain. Villainous. Of course you know, because you saw the drama so many times. Also, yes, at the manor. Do they still perform that regularly?
Yeah.
So unless the acharyas have commented on that, I've never seen an indication of that. But everyone else was like, Dasarath died in the absence of his of Ram's association. I don't know how did Bharat treat his mother after that. I think that said, you know, yeah. It was torture. Any yes?
Is there a mention in verse 14 of the leaders of
Yes, it gives a little more indication of the characters, the character of a Gandhava, the pretending. I couldn't penetrate deeply into that, but the impersonators and intenders, subtle beings. And maybe someone else knows more about that. Yes.
I had another topic.
Well, how about, anyone have any information on that? Maybe you can look it up in the Puranic Encyclopedia. Gandhavas and what is the nature of their existence, how they are pretenders and how they are so wealthy. We know that they're wonderful singers and they're opulent. Narada Muni himself having been one. Yeah.
According to Jivrita, Prabhupada used envy in both the absolute context of malice or just hatred, and also in the context, which is commonly used now, of desiring someone else's asset and wanting to possess it. Feeling negativity because of that.
When I've thought about that, they seem to be one.
They're close, yeah.
They're really close. In other words, when you're envious of someone, you're not wishing, when you're actually experiencing that, you're not wishing them well.
Right. It's interesting, you know, that sometimes Prabhupada will use this term to describe meteors. That yes. Have envy towards
animals yes.
And they'll kill them and eat their bodies. That's a slightly different nuance.
What's the implied meaning? How are they envious of the animals?
Well, it's the envy, you know.
Okay, why don't you say if someone has wealth, someone has a huge piece of gold, and you, what does it mean to be envious of them?
You want that gold.
And also part of that is you can't tolerate that they have it right. When you should have it. Right. So take that same meaning and place it on animals and meat eaters. What do they have?
They got this body.
And they have their life. And you can't tolerate it that they have it. You want it. You want their body. So in that sense, it's envy. Very often it's due to ignorance. Just not thinking in it clearly, just because, you know.
It's an illogical thought process.
Well, it's just that you don't know any better. As soon as you do know any better, you. It's just because parents give it to you, so you take it. You eat it. But then you grow up doing that, and no one tells you that this is actually inimical, and you never think that it's the animals. And it may, you know, you may call it a spare rib, but the animal might not have had the same feeling about his rib, that it's spare, extra.
There's just such a disconnection, you know, between...
Yeah, killing and...
Yeah. I know when before I joined the movement, I was traveling out in Colorado and staying with my girlfriend's uncle, and he... You know, kind of as a duty, as a guest, they had to help slaughter a goat. And the next day, it appeared on the table. You know, it's just like so hellish. And it's just, I hate to bring it up now, but...
Yes, I also hate that you did it.
But it's just that, that usually you don't have that any kind of that connection.
Yeah, between the killing and the eating.
Yeah, you know, the way that it's packaged, you know, and marketed by the meat packers is just, you know, like down.
And if you try to put up a big U and outcry against it, they'll kill you too. At least they'll try. But it seems like it's becoming, you know, the mad cow diseases and things like that are becoming, it's going to drive people away from this type of eating. It's actually mad people disease. Or bad people. And it affects one's conscience. Eating poison, what they do to them, process the meat and artificially do this and pump it up with red fluid so it's, oh, the animals and the when you kill them, the terror, it affects their just like when your a fear enters you, you know, it does something to your body. So when the animals are afraid, it injects some type of hormones into their body which are like poison. Yeah, that's graceful.
I think it's quite a subtle concept for, I think I even have a little trouble sometimes connecting, you know, the slaughter, the mass slaughter of animals and
envy,
world war.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in theory, it makes sense. It's just like, you know, for many years as a devotee, I couldn't understand what's so special about cows, you know? It is a real alien concept, even though we're in the books. And just in recent years, you know, associated with devotees that were that deeply love cows and protected them, you know, started rubbing off. That whole concept, you know.
So what's your realization now?
I don't know if it's complete. You know, I mean, I have much more understanding of the position of cows, you know, and the mystic kind of value that they have in nearness to God. You know, the potency of milk, you know, and how it really strengthens the consciousness. That's starting to awaken. And my guess, after 30 years, you know, it's quite a statement, you know, of the ignorance that Western culture produces, you know, of the value of the cow. It took this many years just to kind of get, you know, a little inkling, you know, of this.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I fully understand, you know, this, you know, that karmic law, you know, that deep realization. I guess it just, you know, just the hellishness, you know, of this modern civilization, it's just so destructive. Just, you know, when I come in contact with it, I'm just, you know, I was picked up at the airport, right? I had a prepaid taxi, and the guy was drunk. He was mad drunk.
I hope it wasn't the driver.
The driver was completely drunk. I mean, couldn't find
You're kidding.
Him, you know, where he was.
And you got in the car?
Yeah, well, it was a prepaid taxi, and I just, you know, Russian roulette, you know, and I got a drunk taxi driver. You know,
and yeah, but how much were you afraid of losing by getting out?
And then it wasn't a full realization. You know, sometimes these drivers are just weird, you know. And I almost did. I came real close right in the very beginning, but then one lets you drive, what can you do? You know, I mean, you're out in the middle of nowhere, and it's 10:30 at night. Took 2 hours to, you know, make a half hour drive, you know, to Nikita's house. So it's just you just get a sense, you know, everything out there is just so hellish. Any kind of contact, they were so cloistered, we're so protected. And then when we have the contact, and I know I've been in the West in 2 years, but I know if I go, it's just gonna be unbelievable cultural shock, you know, to see the degradation of women, you know, and all of the hellish things that are going on. You know, I haven't even been in contact with media. Sometimes I know when I was traveling to Calcutta, I drove by and this guy was just cutting a head off a chicken, and just as I was passing the door, you know, it's such a hellish thing. it's wide open, you know, in India, like that. But, you know, the hell of Western civilization, it really strikes one when he's been away from it. But if you're in it, it's just so contaminating. You know, I know when I would be collect in the West, and then I would be thrust, you know, into these situations with the most degraded people in the world, you know, like the Hell's Angel, you know, the Harley bike lovers, you know. And all this degradation, and it would be, I would feel so contaminated after, you know, selling them the hats and getting their money, and they would offer me their meat and their drugs, and the nudity, it's just so degrading.
I hope you didn't stay in the taxi.
Second, he finally got there. It was a long haul. You know, I almost ran out of battery. You know, I had to get any type of guidance because they don't have proper signage, you know, in the, you know, Gurgaon.
Your austerities you performed to do your service are incredible.
Anybody.
Not everyone goes into sells hats to Hell's Angels. I mean, I never did anyway.
I'm pretty happy about time. And
did you ever do that?
What?
Sell hats to Hell's Angels?
Do what?
You don't even know what it is.
Sell hats, Harley Davidson hats.
No, it's not everyone who does that. Have you ever done that, Mataji? Very good. Narak Apsara.
No, they're a little different from ourselves.
30% of the first 8 years I was in India, I did that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. What austerities you performed
to. Yeah, pretty hard. And then the consciousness that it produced, oh my God. And then I come back to China and run a medical institution. You know, after 3 or 4 months of that.
Okay. Any more comments?
Go ahead. Was that enough?
What was their center?
What was that?
Center.
Oh, they have a few.
This is the key.
At that time, they had about 12 all around the world.
No. But what would, say there's a community, what was the center of it? What was the force that kept them together?
Well, they would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and meet in the temple room. And every day, they were ecumenic minded. So they would have a prayer for each different religion every day. And they would be vegetarian. They followed the four ignited principles more or less. And they were reading all the different scriptures.
So there was some piety there.
Yeah, completely. I mean, he was a Catholic. Very, very, very very clean, pure Catholic person. He was very talented, actually. Even physically, he was like a giant. And his wife also.
So he had a leader.
Yeah, he was a great leader.
That's one point.
Yeah.
You need to do something there, like this, you need a great leader.
When I was there, he had left his body 6 years prior to that.
Yeah.
But he had started his community with 40 of his friends. And these people were still kind of there, more or less. They were called the companions.
Still there?
Yeah. This is, I even know other devotees who went there to some of these communities, and they didn't have, most of them didn't have electricity or gas. They were completely very, it's very well organized. If you want to know more about it, I can tell you. Very interesting.
So,
they have their own school.
If you want to ask, I could give some comments about what our difficulties were. One thing that Prabhupada said on the positive is that the center of the community has to be the deities.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone's center is to please them. That's what makes it work in Krishna consciousness, that everyone wants to please them. But then you need a leader too. You need a strong, very intelligent, qualified, knows how to deal with the material energy and, you know, knows how to deal with people. And it sounds like it's one thing. And then also there's, you need the real practical financial stuff too, and that's really caused problems in our
they probably started with something, I would imagine. Not really.
Well, they started very slowly.
Yeah. See, that maybe we tried to start too quickly. And also they started with 40 friends. We start with, you know, 40 people who just happen to be there often.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's many things. I mean, not that, you know, I'm not in any way either making excuses or saying that they haven't done something quite extraordinary. But they had they have to have a real binding force. You have to have a real center and something that you're believing in. Also in Israel, there are so many kibbutzes that of many different varieties. I mean, you can say something about what makes the ones work, if you know.
No, or it's not work anymore. But in the beginning, yes, some very ideology of community to share together.
Yeah.
To equal with each other.
And also there was necessity.
And there was a necessity, yes.
It was either all of us or none of us. That helps too, in a sense. Because I've seen what keeps people together very much, whether it's marriage or communities, when you realize you need each other. As soon as that's gone, then the respect is...
That's the problem in
ISKCON,
is people are moving too much. They're moving from one problem.
That is the problem or a problem?
One problem in ISKCON is that they're moving too much, not stable enough in one place to invest their energy, their relationships.
You need a very strong ego for this. That we are very special, and so it's a problem. Yes.
A sense that you're doing something very important and special.
Yes,
and
you are very special also. Yeah. And the other knows, and you are stronger.
But how do you get that? That sense.
No, this is the binding that holds there.
But how does the binding come about? How does that feeling come about?
I don't know, but it's come.
Yeah.
Yes, it's
important. Well, he was, Avram was saying false ego.
Yes, of course.
But you can do it by leadership too. You know, the sense of mission, the importance of the mission. But I mean, if it is true.
Yes, and what is it that it's true?
I know what made me say that was what things that Prabhupada, he did explain to us many times the importance of the mission. We hear it again and again how bad the world situation is, and you can actually do something. Not easy, communities, because we're brought up in such an individualistic way. So you really...
The first generation it's okay, but the second and the third it's tearing apart.
Yeah, that's your experience.
Yes, this is Israel's experience.
But our experience is even the first generation is difficult. We don't even get the chance for the second and third often. We, under Prabhupada's supervision, he tried to get us to do these things. There were quite a few farm, rural communities, but the devotees were all city people also. It was very difficult for them to live in the... Any other questions or comments?
Like yesterday's section, I had Bruce brought it up in the recap. Prabhupada, this is the description of the modern weaponry of Ravana's army as opposed to the sticks and stones that Ram's monkey army used. And then Prabhupada says there's two types of power, daiva, which is derived from transcendence, and purushakar, which is derived from one's illusory power, you know, derived from one's own intelligence and one's own power. And of the two, the daiva is more superior. You know, I've known of this purport for many years, and a lot of times I feel that you know, in the course of different services I've had, you know, that I'm kind of tap into Purusha Kari, you know, I got certain karma propensities and can be successful, you know, in a particular service because it has so much to do with our Krishna or depending upon him. You know, there's a whole illusion that I'm functioning with. And I'm just wondering if, you know, how devotees can kind of transit from a Purushakar power into one of dependence. You know, Prabhupada had enormous capabilities, but yet he was fully dependent. It was a deep humility, and it seems that that's a big part of the equation, is the humility. And that to see the Dabara plumes are ours, and, you know, and then somehow we're great people because we can use what Krishna has bestowed upon us. But it's a difficult one, I found, you know, I really feel that I'm empowered by Daiva as opposed to Purushakar.
To feel like you are?
Say again?
Is that the difficulty, to feel like you are or to be?
Well, to realize that it's Krishna that's doing it, not me. I guess that's...
But is Krishna the one doing it? Anyway, I'll answer... No. Yes, but there's a difference between being empowered and using whatever Krishna's given you in his service. There's a lot more energy comes through when you're empowered. So, my answer to your question was primarily, how do you transit from one to the other? Depending on Krishna and using and letting be an instrument of his energy, and you gave the hint on humility in that. So I would say the most important thing is the sincere attempt to continue, because even if you start with your own power, however much power you have, it will prove to be insufficient. And if you just continue, no matter how big your false ego is, you'll be brought to the position of understanding no matter what you have, it's insufficient. And then if you really want to sincerely do that service for Krishna and you're just sticking to it, you'll be forced to call out to him for his help. Because whatever you have, great as it may be, it will be insufficient. That's my answer to that. And is, in other words, to continue doing a service.
It seems that the process itself that's
or just like when you were distributing books, you used to distribute books. There's a certain ability that you have, right? But how many times in every week did your ability prove insufficient, and you had to realize that it was actually Krishna? And go to do it.
This is in reference to that service. So I never had a bad day in the Sankirtan in the whole 16 years I did.
Yeah.
I used to say to the devotees, you know, this is kind of like Purushakar, because I can be in a complete mind and still do really well with it.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that was something, you know, with this service that I got now, it's a little different.
What you're doing now, I understand what you mean. And we can have half of Mayapur agreeing with that point. But you've learned to not take yourself as seriously, too.
Yeah.
So maybe,
I think I still have some learning to do.
Well, yeah, we all do. Okay.
You're helping.
The Bhagavatam is helping.
Yeah. It seems that the process itself just creates that.
And living a life of service. You know, the first 30 years of your life are like that. They're almost like meant to build up your strength and sense of ego, false ego. And then the rest of it is taking it down.
I mean, the first 30 years of life is a devotee.
Yeah, or no, just in life. And then the rest is learning that Nokia, Prasadta. And the rest of life is learning, because if you're too self-conscious of yourself and understand you're insufficient in the beginning of your life, it doesn't work well for you. You have to be built up almost. But then if you continue with that the rest of your life, you're intolerable as an adult. But it's natural. You know, that's what midlife crisis is. I've heard it defined in that way. Whatever you've done, you know, because everyone has gifts. Whether it's intelligence or beauty or strength or cunningness or who knows what. But so in the first half of your life, you're using all your gifts to get what you want, either on the material level or the spiritual level. But then at some point, you hit the rock of your fate. And whatever you have proves itself to be insufficient. No matter how big it is, no matter how you've used it, but it proves to be insufficient. And then you have a crash of false ego, which is the beginning. If you, instead of trying to build up your false ego again, usually by criticizing everyone else, and it's all their fault, if you sit with it and you realize that you're you can rebuild yourself in a different way as a mature adult and be more dependent on Krishna. And if there are people who go through their lives without a crash, they're intolerable, arrogant, overly arrogant. But no devotee has that experience. Look how Prabhupada had to suffer so much and struggle so much of his life. And therefore Krishna was readying him to be the most successful.
Was that one of the preparatory did this book, you know, interviewed different personalities that had associated with Prabhupada. And before he started his gun. And there was one example that really stuck in my mind. There was a Baba that was living next to Radha Damodar temple. And in the middle of the night, he was awoken by someone really crying intensely, you know, to Krishna. And he didn't think anything out of it. And then again, the next night. And then he went out, and it was like maybe 1 or 2 in the morning, and Prabhupada was sitting. Goswami's samadhi cleaning, and it was this intense cry to Krishna. I don't exactly remember what he was saying, but it was just the intensity that was conveyed. See,
and to do the kind of wonderful service that Krishna wants you to do in Mayapur, you can't do it on your own power. It's too big. You can distribute a book to someone. Okay.
That's simple.
But this is big.
Well, you know, just...
But the one thing is...
Yeah.
Why don't we end now officially and we can talk more if you like. I mean, you have to understand that. Otherwise, there's the call of your prayer doesn't have that intensity. But it's hard for us who have thick false egos to do that. Who go so far. But death will teach us. You know, when your body starts falling apart, that'll teach you. Because
yeah.
There's nothing you can do.
One thing that I found though, in this, my experience in the last 3 months of just being here, that wonderful things happened, even though I didn't have anything to do with it.
How dare they? You see,
so that is
what happens if they declare that you're obsolete?
No, it just shows how Krishna's going on ultimately, and that the illusory.
Limit the karan, bhavya savya sachin. Bhagavatam ki jai, Shri Prabhupada ki jai, Sri Ram Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram ki jai.